Okay, so now we can move on to the next sutta, and the name of this sutta is the Simile of the Lamp, and this is found in the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, the Samyutta Nikaya, the 54th chapter, where is the 54th chapter? Actually, that's the chapter on mindfulness of breathing, that's right. And this is the 8th sutta in that particular chapter here. So we're going to look at the idea of mindfulness of breathing in quite a bit of detail. The sutta itself is quite abbreviated, but I've kind of added in all the details about mindfulness of breathing here. Just to get an overview of how that practice is talked about in the suttas and how the Buddha envisions the kind of progress in through mindfulness of breathing here. But before I talk about the sutta, I just want to say a little bit more about the things we were talking about yesterday evening in the Q&A about samatha and vipassana, and how this is understood in the suttas, because it is understood quite differently from how it is often understood these days, in the various traditions of Buddhism. And many of the Buddhist traditions are so-called vipassana traditions, and there's a tendency in the Buddhist world to divide meditation into two different parts, vipassana meditation and samatha meditation. And there is an assumption among meditators that this is how the Buddha taught meditation, but in fact it is not. And this comes as a surprise, I think, to many people, that for the Buddha there is no distinction, there isn't any vipassana meditation and samatha meditation, there is just meditation. And the main way that the Buddha talks about meditation practice is mindfulness of breathing. And so that meditation, if you do it in the right way, is both vipassana and samatha at the same time. How can that be? And the reason is because samatha and vipassana are outcomes of meditation practice. If you practice in the right way, whatever it is that you do, whatever it is that you contemplate or watch or observe or whatever, or whatever practices you do, including sila, including sila itself, all of these things, they lead to two results. And the two results are samatha, the calm, and vipassana, clear seeing. And so everything on the Buddhist path is aimed at these two things. And there isn't any one practice that leads to one or the other. If the practice works, it always must lead to both of them. And the reason is, as I mentioned yesterday, because the cause is the same. The cause of samatha, the cause of vipassana, is always the reduction of the defilements. And when the defilements go down, then both of these are a result. And I talked about this at a bit of length yesterday, so you sort of have some idea of why that must be the case. So this is really important. So when we come now to mindfulness of breathing, it is not a samatha practice, nor is it a vipassana practice. It is both. And you may wonder maybe, well, what about, is there any practices that are kind of, what about alternative practices? One of the things that we find in the suttas is the development of perception, for example. The suttas talk about the development of the perception of impermanence, the development of the perception of non-delight in the whole world. I mentioned that yesterday. Development of the perception of non-self, development of perception of drawbacks in things, the development of perception of cessation. There's all kinds of perceptions. And if you look at those perceptions, they have to do with seeing the world clearly. So if there is a kind of something that leans towards vipassana in the suttas, it is the development of perception. That is where you find that leaning towards vipassana. But even those development of perceptions, they are not called vipassana. And the reason why they're not called vipassana is because if they work, if you are successful in seeing things clearly, it will lead again to both results, samatha and vipassana. Everything which works on the Buddhist path leads to both these qualities. So when we come now to mindfulness of breathing, it's useful to keep this in mind. And this is why the Buddha says that mindfulness of breathing is sufficient to take you all the way to awakening, because it includes samatha and vipassana. All the insights that are required are an outcome of this practice, when it works properly and you take it all the way to its kind of conclusion. So this is kind of useful to know. And this is why, as I mentioned before, the Buddhist path can really be summarized in a very simple way to morality as a foundation, and then mindfulness of breathing on top of that morality. And these two things are enough to take you all the way to awakening. Yeah, it's so simple. It's so incredibly easy. You just be kind and watch the breath. That's all you have to do. And bang, you become an arahant. Yeah, isn't that cool? I love it. It is so simple. And yet, of course, applying this and actually doing it, that is the hard part. Yeah, you just have to, we really have to understand what these things mean fully. We talked quite a bit about sila already. And it's, to me, a very interesting area because it is so profound. Just the idea of being kind is such a profound thing here. But now let us focus on mindfulness of breathing and get a better understanding of how this actually is done according to the suttas, the standard exposition. So this is the simile of the lamp, and at the very end of the sutta we get to that particular simile. It's a very profound and beautiful simile for the conclusion of the path. And now that we're getting close to the end of this retreat, yeah, it's kind of nice to look at some of these more concluding aspects of the path. But then, so then the Buddha starts out, and he says, mendicants, when samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is very fruitful and beneficial. How so? So first of all, you will notice the expression here, samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing. And this is a fairly common expression in the suttas. It means that samadhi is often developed based on mindfulness of breathing, including the jhanas, including everything. Yeah, this is really the path, the most common way of achieving samadhi in the suttas. And then it is very fruitful and beneficial. And of course, when the Buddha says it is very fruitful and beneficial, he doesn't mince his words. He really means very fruitful and beneficial. And as it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, the main sutta on this topic, found in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya 118, is basically just the same as here with a little bit in addition to it. It says that you do this, it fulfills the four Satipatthana practices. Yeah, which in turn fulfill the seven factors of awakening, which in turn fulfill knowledge and vision, which is the end of the path, which is arahantship and awakening itself. So it takes you all the way, and it fulfills all of these important categories that we talk about all the time in conjunction with meditation practice. So how is it so beneficial and fruitful? And so then the Buddha goes on. It's when a mendicant gone to the wilderness, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down cross-legged, sets their body straight, and establishes mindfulness in front of them. Just mindful, they breathe in. Mindful, they breathe out. So here it starts off, and this is, of course, all of these little words here are very interesting, because this is the preliminary practices or the preliminary things that are required for this meditation to really take hold. And very often, some of the most important information is found in the preliminary practices, especially when we take into account that meditation is largely an automatic process. Yeah, you don't have to do anything. You sit back, you relax, and you allow it to happen. For that to work, you need to get the foundation into place. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So this is maybe the most important part of the instructions here. And he starts off with gone to a wilderness, jhana grove. I guess we kind of qualify almost like a wilderness. We are quite far away. Look around. It has a kind of slightly wild feeling here. It's pretty civilized wilderness when you come in here and you get such nice food and everything. But it's still, nevertheless, it is kind of a bit out of the city anyway. So this is kind of a nice halfway house of being gone to the wilderness. To the root of a tree, it's a similar kind of idea. In India, some of these trees are magnificent trees with large roots, and you can kind of almost go inside the root, because the roots kind of spread out. And so they can become almost like little huts to sit inside the root of a tree like that. or to an empty hut, sunyagara, an empty house, an empty dwelling. Yeah. So the idea here with these words is that all of these three imply solitude. Yeah, they imply that you have left your ordinary life behind. They imply the Pali word viveka. Viveka means seclusion. It means solitude. It means being on your own. It means taking yourself out of your ordinary environment, taking you out of the five-sense world around you, taking you out of the city and the village and other people and all of these kind of things, moving away from the world. And if you think about what city life or life in the world is, it is really a life of enjoying the five senses. Yeah? If city life is about that, it's about having entertainment around you, having restaurants around you. This is where you kind of date people, yeah, in the city. All of these things happen in the city. City is a sensual realm. And so by withdrawing from the city and the villages and these kind of things, you are withdrawing externally from the five sense realm. And this is the idea. And this is actually what happens right here in Jhana Grove. Yeah, we are withdrawing from that realm. It is fairly simple. We keep in the eight precepts. Nothing much is happening. So in that sense, we are really there. We're doing the right thing, withdrawing from that world. And once you withdraw physically from that world, of course, then it gives the mind an opportunity to also withdraw from that world. If you are bombarded with five sense impressions all the time, with the delights of the five sense impressions all the time, it is impossible for the mind to withdraw, because you're always reminded, you're always stimulated, you're always kind of drawn back into that realm. But once you go into seclusion, there is a chance that you can withdraw from that. So physical seclusion, then mental seclusion, always in that order. And this shows us that the idea of mindfulness of breathing is something very profound. Yeah, this is not a kind of some simple little meditation. And if you think that mindfulness of breathing is difficult, and if you have a hard time following the breath, of course you have a hard time. Of course it is going to be difficult. It is to be expected. It is a very profound meditation. It is a meditation that happens in solitude. If you try to do mindfulness of breathing at home, in your ordinary life, it is not going to be easy at all. Sometimes you may succeed because your mind is kind of in the right state. A lot of the time it will be very hard. And some of you mentioned that to me, that, you know, at home it is hard to do meditation. When you come to a meditation center, it's much easier. When you hang around the right kind of people, the kalyanamittas, the atmosphere is right, the feeling, the mood is right, everything kind of falls into place. It makes it much easier. Sometimes you can be successful meditating at home as well, and I know that some of you are, but it tends to be much more difficult because of that. Real meditation happens in solitude. It happens away. This is kind of the message here. It is a profound thing. Mindfulness of breathing is a very profound way of doing meditation. This is the real meditation of the Buddha. This is not Mickey Mouse meditation. Sorry, I just had to say that. I apologize. So this is the real deal. So this is the beginning point, the idea of seclusion. And then you sit down with cross-legged sitting down. So real meditation is in seclusion, and it happens in the sitting posture. Mindfulness of breathing is very difficult to do while you're walking. It's too coarse. You can do it lying down, that's possible, but the sitting posture is the preeminent posture for mindfulness of breathing. That's why the Buddha says this. Cross-legged is nice, because it is a very nice posture. Once you get used to it, it feels very solid and steady. You can sit cross-legged in various ways with various supports and things. And you can try that, but it's not really necessary. It is fully possible to attain deep samadhi by sitting on a chair or by leaning against the wall or whatever. The posture is not so important in this sense. And many people I know, they get very good meditation by lying down. They are watching the breath while lying down. That's also possible if you have a fairly solid mindfulness to begin with. So the main purpose of the posture is not that there is some magic to a particular posture. Yeah. The main purpose is to kind of get the body out of the way. Yeah, yeah, the body, if the body is either prominent because there is pain, or the body is prominent because you are indulging the body, then you have a problem. So the idea is for the body to kind of disappear, not to be a problem anymore. And for this reason, it is not useful, in my opinion, to watch painful feelings too much. Forget about those painful feelings. Yeah, enjoy meditation. That is kind of, this is one of the things I always loved about Ajahn Brahm. Everything was about enjoying. And so I thought, okay, Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. Yeah, enjoying the path. Isn't that wonderful? I think it's just so important. Yeah, I mean, the spiritual life, what is, should the spiritual life be about unless it is to enhance the quality of life, to move away from suffering? Yeah. And if we're going to move away from suffering, we might as well start right away. Yeah, if we kind of the idea that you have to endure lots of pain so that you can get out of suffering, there's something wrong with that. And in fact, the Buddha specifically says that he too had that wrong view prior to his awakening, that happiness is to be gained through pain. This is the Jain teaching. Standing on one leg for 10 years and then somehow that will lead to happiness in the future. The Buddha says it's wrong view. Sitting on your bottom watching pain in your legs for 10 years, it's the same kind of idea. The idea that somehow by watching pain or being with pain, we're going to have success. But what we shall see in the Anapanasati Sutta shortly, there's nothing here about watching pain at all. It's all about pleasant states of mind. And this is kind of the beauty of this. So you sit down in a posture where your body kind of disappears. It is no longer important. That is the right kind of posture. You set your body straight. And again, the straightness of the body tends to happen by itself. When your mindfulness gets reasonably clear, you just want to have a straight body because the straightness of the body tends to enhance the mindfulness. And then you establish mindfulness in front of you. Yeah, this is the last one here. And you will notice again, as I mentioned before, you establish mindfulness in front of you even before you breathe, even before you are aware of the breath. Mindfulness comes first, then comes the awareness of the breath afterwards. And I did discuss this briefly before. In front of you just means in the present space and the present time. It means here and now. It doesn't mean any other kind of mindfulness, such as recollecting the past or recollecting the qualities of the Buddha or anything like that. It means in the present space, the present time. That seems to be the main meaning of this. And then this is refined in the commentaries to mean watching the tip of your nose and your upper lip and these kind of things. But that seems to be a later interpretation, which may not be wrong, but it's not exactly what you find in the Pali here. So what does it mean to establish mindfulness before you watch the breath? The thing is that when you sit down and you know, the breath tends to always be there. It's never very far away because it's part of the experience. But the point is that it's not so much that you kind of get rid of the breath. That's not really the point because the breath tends to be there. The point is just that you kind of leave the breath aside. You don't worry about the breath. This is kind of the point. And what you kind of are more concerned about is establishing a mindfulness. It is like, what is your primary purpose? What is your primary object? And your primary object is to establish mindfulness. Yes, the breath may be around, but you are not really concerned about it. And then you do what is required to establish mindfulness, which means relaxing, allowing things to be, using these kind of various similes, doing a bit of death contemplation, having the sense that you're just resting. You forget about the word meditation. Actually, this is rest time, relax time. And all of this perception that allows you to really relax and then mindfulness to come as a consequence of that. And then the idea of nudging the mind in the right direction, overcoming the defilements. If you see a bit of ill will, you use some of the perception and techniques I've been talking about. If there's too much ill will, no need to even sit down. You just need to do something else in the meantime. But if it's just a little bit, you can overcome it. See the mind being restless, and thinking about things in the world. Well, again, you use some of these ideas we've been talking about, looking at things in a different way, understanding that the sensory realm is not all that interesting here. What I'm doing now in meditation, this is what is interesting here. And then you give rise to that mindfulness. That is what your focus is on. And then as the mindfulness then arises, there comes a point when you feel a degree of clarity, a degree of stillness, the thinking is kind of subsiding, and that is where the breath kind of becomes more, the breath is there more powerfully. You are with the breath, and you are almost by default doing mindfulness of breathing straight away. You don't need to focus on it, you don't need to do anything in particular. Just the clarity of the mind means that the breath is there with you. It's like a friend. You are there together. No need to point your mind in any particular direction or anything like that. And this is exactly what we see next. Yeah, you establish mindfulness in front of you, and then just mindful, you breathe in. Mindful, you breathe out. In other words, you don't look at the breath, you don't watch the breath. But because you are mindful, and then you breathe in, obviously you're going to be aware of the breath, because that's just what mindfulness does. Mind, the breath is there, the mindfulness is there, and you're doing mindfulness of breathing. So it's easy, it is comfortable, there's no force involved in this, and this is the idea. And even little words there, like just mindful, sattova, sattova, sati plus eva. Eva means, it's a little word in Pali which means like just. In other words, nothing else. No willpower, no focusing, nothing is really required. All you have to do is to be mindful. No intention is required of you at all. And so then it becomes very easy and very kind of comfortable. And then you can really enjoy the whole process of mindfulness of breathing. So that is the introductory part, and a lot of this is about establishing mindfulness, and this is the hardest part of all. It is of course very interesting that mindfulness is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? There are six factors coming before that, and that says a lot about why mindfulness is not so easy to establish, because all of these other factors have to be practiced first. In our daily life, in our ordinary life, but also during the meditation itself, both of these things. And then over time, mindfulness becomes very strong because we do these things fully and well. Okay, so background finished. Now let's get into the real, what actually happens. So breathing in heavily, or sometimes called the long breath, breathing in long, they know I'm breathing in heavily. Breathing out heavily, they know I'm breathing out heavily. When breathing in lightly, they know I'm breathing in lightly. Breathing out lightly, they know I'm breathing out lightly. They practice like this. I'll breathe in experiencing the whole body or the whole breath. I'll practice like this. I'll breathe out experiencing the whole body. I'll practice like this. I'll breathe in stilling the physical process. The practice like this, I'll breathe out, stilling the physical process. So this is the beginning, the first four steps of mindfulness of breathing. There is 16 steps in all, and four times four, and each group of four is equivalent to one of the satipatthanas. The four satipatthanas, the four mindfulness meditations, is the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body, vedana nupassana, the contemplation of feelings, our sensations, citta nupassana, contemplation of mind, and dhamma nupassana, contemplation of qualities or something like that. So four areas of mindfulness meditation, and the 16 steps of Anapanasati correspond. You have four at the time correspond to each of the satipatthanas. And so this first one then corresponds to body contemplation, the kaya nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. And which is interesting, yeah, kaya nupassana, all you have to do is watch the breath. You don't really have to do much more than that. And if the breath meditation works, it means that you are doing kaya nupassana. That's all really that you have to do. And it starts off by watching the long breath, then you have the short breath. What does that mean? Does that mean that you have to be aware of the breath as long or short and these kind of things? The answer is not really. It is not about knowing the particular quality of the breath. It is about knowing the breath. But this is the sequence that usually happens. Yeah, usually the breath is long to begin with, and as you start to become more peaceful, it becomes shorter because you require less oxygen and these kind of things. The bodily process is kind of winding down a bit. But it's not about knowing whether the breath is short or long. It is certainly not about making the breath long or short. It's just about being aware of the breath. Yeah, every breath you are aware. That is really the idea here. And then once that that degree of mindfulness is established, you continue practicing. And it says here that you practice like this. I will breathe in, experiencing the whole body. Yeah, or you train like this. And that training, that practice that you're doing, is not actually doing anything in particular. It is just allowing the process to happen. Your job is to be present. Your job is to stand back. Your job is to allow a certain spaciousness and awareness in the mind. And as you do that, this is just the nature of things. Things calm down. So what does it mean to experience the whole body? This is one of those controversial things in Buddhism. Does it mean the whole physical body? Or does it mean the whole breath? And according to the commentaries, it means the whole breath, yeah, which makes very good sense. We are doing breath meditation, not body meditation, so it makes very good sense that breath is what it means in this context. And that is what I think it means. I'm just following Ajahn Brahm, really, when I say that. But it also makes good sense from a sutta point of view. So it's like you're awareness is becoming more refined, yeah? First of all, you're just aware of individual breaths. Now you are aware of the whole breath. It means that your awareness is becoming sharper. You know more what is going on. But it is an automatic process. Yeah, and you can feel that your mind is changing. You're gaining more clarity. You're gaining more ability to see. You're seeing more of your experience. And then, as you carry on in the same way, without really doing anything, but just allowing the process to unfold, the process starts to become more peaceful, right? It's the calming down, which is the next one here. The physical process is stilling the physical process. And of course, the physical process, the kaya sankhara is the Pali word here. Kaya sankhara is actually the breath itself. Kaya sankharang pasambati. Pasambati is to calm down. And the previous one is sabbakayang patisangvedi, experiencing the whole body, I think. Sabbakaya patisangvedi. So you allow the process to become more peaceful, right? The breath is becoming more calm. It is becoming less prominent. It's kind of starting to fade away. This is what's happening with the breath here, fading away as it becomes more peaceful. And already at this point, actually from the very beginning here, if you are properly aware, properly mindful, it is already feeling quite pleasant, especially when the breath starts to calm down. It's starting to become quite enjoyable. There's no great amount of bliss yet at this particular point, but just the peaceful observation of the breath is actually a pleasant experience. It doesn't take that long before this meditation becomes quite delightful. So this is the idea of the meditation, of the body contemplation. Yeah, the first tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta. Quite simple, quite straightforward. And this particular tetrad is also found in the Satipatthana Sutta. If you go to the Satipatthana Sutta, it mentions exactly these four steps in that sutta itself. The difference is that in the Satipatthana Sutta, it then does not mention mindfulness of breathing after that. It doesn't go on with mindfulness of breathing. After that, it just talks about feelings and mind in a very general sense. And it doesn't say exactly how you're supposed to watch those feelings or watch the mind. So the Satipatthana Sutta is almost a bit misleading. Yeah, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, you get the impression that mindfulness of breathing only belongs to the very beginning and does not belong to the later stages of meditation. And because of that, and because many of the Buddhist traditions, they rely almost exclusively on the Satipatthana Sutta, they actually then teach in accordance with that. So you watch the breath first of all, then you stop watching the breath and you watch the experiencing in the sensations in the body and these kind of things. This is a standard way that meditation is taught in within what they call the vipassana, certain vipassana schools. Really, and that may not be wrong as such, but it is a bit misleading because actually, and this is what we're going to see next, anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, covers all the aspects of Satipatthana, not just the body. So the impression that you get from the Satipatthana Sutta is actually misleading. And for that reason, it is very interesting to do, a historical research into these suttas to see what is likely to be the most original part of these suttas. And lo and behold, what you find when you do that, this has been done by a number of people. These days we have textual transmissions from a large number of lineages and schools. We have in Chinese, we have in Tibetan, we have in Sanskrit. And when you compare the various lineages and schools, you find out that actually that Anapanasati, that first tetrad, probably does not belong in the Satipatthana Sutta at all. And once you take it out, then it kind of makes more sense, because then it doesn't give the impression that it's only in the first Kaya Nupassana where it belongs. Once you take it out, then you have to come back to the Anapanasati Sutta, and this gives you the real information on how to practice mindfulness of breathing here. I don't know if that makes any sense to you what I said now. If it doesn't make any sense, don't worry about it. The main point here is looking at the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. So this is how we start off with the Mindfulness of Breathing, the first tetrad. So that's the starting point, already very nice. And now it gets even more interesting. Yeah, now we come into the second tetrad, the second group of four. And this is what should happen if you get it right. They practice like this. I will breathe in experiencing rapture. They practice like this. I will breathe out experiencing rapture. They practice like this. I will breathe in experiencing bliss. They practice like this. I will breathe out experiencing bliss. They practice like this. I'll breathe in experiencing mental processes. They practice like this. I will breathe out experiencing mental processes. The practice like this, I will breathe in stilling the mental processes. The practice like this, I will breathe out stilling the mental processes. So this is starting to sound pretty cool, isn't it? Rapture and bliss. I don't know about these mental processes, that sound a bit not so exciting, but certainly the bliss and the rapture here is kind of sounds like a good deal. Yeah, who doesn't want more bliss in their life? And so here we are coming into the second aspect of Satipatthana, which is the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feeling. And this is how you contemplate feeling through the Anapanasati, through mindfulness of breathing. And you will see here that first of all you have rapture, which is piti in Pali, and then you have bliss, which is sukha in Pali. To experience these things. Then you have these mental processes, and you may wonder what that is, with good reason, because it's not obvious at all. The Pali word is citta sankhara, and citta sankhara really just means the content of your mind, specifically the perceptions and the feelings of the mind. There isn't much sankhara here. Sankhara is the doing of the mind, you're allowing the doing to fade away. The body is also fading away because now the feelings are becoming prominent. So the prominent aspect now are the feelings and perceptions. Sanya and Vedana are the two main things. This is called citta sankhara in the Pali language. And so what are those feelings? What are those perceptions? Well, they are really just what we're seeing already. They are the piti, they are the sukha. Yeah, and maybe some bodily thing in the background or senses, but mainly just piti and sukha. That's the main thing they are referring to here. Yeah? So you are experiencing this, and then you calm those things down. Yeah, whatever feelings you have, whatever perceptions you have, they are calmed down further. Yeah? So again, it is all really about positive feelings. This whole process of the four stages here is all about feelings, positive feelings. Citta, sankhara, and pasambhati is the last one. And now you're already getting a feeling for what are the main kind of ideas, the main things that are supposed to happen in meditation practice. We've already seen the idea of calming things down twice, calming the breath. Now we're talking about calming feelings and perceptions. Yeah, it has occurred twice already. We have already seen the idea of happy feelings, yeah, going now four times in the second tetrada. And as I mentioned before, these are the two kind of main areas in which, through which you know whether the meditation is going in the right direction or not. Yeah, the degree of calm and peace that you have on the one hand, and then the degree of happiness and bliss that you have on the other hand. These are the two things, these are the signposts of the mind that tell you whether you're going in the right direction or not. More peace you have, the more you know you're heading in the right direction. The more bliss you have, the more profound that bliss is, the more you know the meditation is heading in the right direction. These are the two main signposts of meditation. And it is not so, often we focus on the object. Yeah, what is the object of meditation? The breath, the nimittas, these kind of things. But the Buddha always focuses on the feelings, the experience, the personal experience. What does it feel like? It feels peaceful. It feels blissful. Then you know you are on the right track. Yeah? There are additional things on top of that. You can talk about mindfulness, talk about energy, you can talk about the clarity of mind, all of these kind of things. But the two main focuses is the bliss and the peace of mind. That is how you know you're on the right track. So what is very interesting about this, and what makes this thing so fascinating, this the second tetrad, there is nothing there about painful feelings. It is all about happy feelings. It is all about really enjoying yourself. And so you start to wonder when you go to the Satipatthana Sutta. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it says, yeah, it says there that you contemplate various kinds of feelings. It talks about dukkha, dukkha feelings, sukha feelings, adukkamasukha, neither happy nor painful feelings. It talks about samisa feelings and niramisa feelings. Samisa means like worldly feelings. Yeah, and amisa actually means flesh. So it means with the flesh and without the flesh, or carnal and non-carnal is kind of a traditional English way of talking about these things. And so you're talking about spiritual feelings and worldly things. I think that's maybe the best way of talking about them. But the thing is that in the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about painful feelings. And here it does not. And this is where we are, where there is a problem. And this is why there seems to be a contradiction between the two. One of the reasons why in many types of meditation instructions that tell you to watch the painful feeling is precisely because the painful feelings are mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta. And yet here, they are not mentioned. So how can we unify this? How do we get these things to work together when there seems to be discrepancy? And the answer is that understanding something is not the same as experiencing it. Yeah, you don't necessarily gain much insight into painful feeling by experiencing it. The main way to get insight into things is to actually see them, as mentioned this before, is when things cease, when things come to an end. So if you want to understand painful feeling properly, it is when they are not present that you actually gain an understanding of this. And again, it's that same simile that I mentioned before of the tadpole. As long as the tadpole is in the water, it cannot understand what water is. When the tadpole becomes a frog, it emerges from the water. Okay, now it understands, because now it is able to compare. It has perspective on what is going on. The same thing is true for painful feelings and many other things on the path. You don't have to experience it. Yeah, thank goodness we don't have to experience all this painful feeling. Yeah, and then you start to see what is going on. When it disappears, when it is gone, then you have a contrast, then you have perspective, then it's possible to see these things. And that is such a wonderful thing to realize, because it means that your approach to meditation can actually be quite different from maybe what you think may have thought before. You can recalibrate a little bit the way you think about this. And this is one of the outcomes of reading the suttas more broadly. One of the biggest problems in meditation circles is that there's a tendency to focus on maybe one or a few suttas, not really having a broad understanding of the word of the Buddha. And if you focus only on one sutta, because it gives you only one angle on the idea of meditation, it can give you the wrong impression. Once you have a broader understanding, it actually allows you a more complete you see things from different angles. It gives a more complete understanding of what is going on. So it is enough to have bliss. Yeah, bliss is enough. No need to have all these painful feelings. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. Do you approve of that? Or do you disapprove of that? I hope you approve of that, because for me, this is one of those beautiful, delicious little discoveries that you get when you read the suttas. You start to understand the overall view of these things, how it actually works. And this is what this is about. So how do we make this transition then? Sometimes people say they are watching the breath, but they don't, and they feel peaceful, but they don't get any joy, they don't get the rapture, they don't get the happiness. Why is that so hard, and how can we make that transition? Very often it just happens by itself. You are just watching the breath, and because you are living well, you feel good about yourself, and the rapture just arises because you already have a foundational good feeling about yourself. Yeah, you know that you are a good person, and you have good feelings about yourself. So that is one way, the most simple way of doing this. But also, this is also where sometimes it may be necessary to nudge your mind a little bit, to kind of look at the world to remind yourself of the Buddha, remind yourself of all the Kalyanamittas that are around, remind yourself of all the blessings in your life, having a bit of gratitude for all these amazing things that you have discovered, having gratitude for the fact that we have such a powerful Buddhist community here in Perth. People come from around the world, they come from everywhere to be here, precisely because what we have here is actually quite unique. How many places in the world do you find a monk's monastery with over 30 monks and a nun's monastery with 15 or nuns or whatever it is at Dhammasara Monastery? This is incredibly rare in the world, and it's a very strong Buddhist community. And they're not just a bunch of scallywag monks and nuns either, They are the real deal. These are real monks and real nuns practicing properly. What a wonderful thing that is. And then the very strong lay community, with some of the practitioners in the lay community that are really awesome, awesome lay people that we have here in Perth. Then the awesome lay people from overseas, they come here as well. And then we kind of have the kind of awesome squared, because of kind of the awesomeness of from many different angles. And then you feel really uplifted when you think like that. And then that can help you to bring the joy. Or you kind of just very briefly, like I tried yesterday in the guided meditation yesterday, that's the idea of that you are living well. You have been living on the five precepts. You have been trying to live with kindness. And what that actually does to the world when you do that, you're giving people freedom from fear, from anxiety. You are giving people the gift of kind words and all these kind of things. What a wonderful thing that is. You are supplying something beautiful to the world. And you have every reason to feel glad about that. It's just about how you reflect on these things. And this is such a nice way of living, feeling good about yourself. And then you are lifting up your spirits. You don't feel a big ego. This has nothing to do with ego at all. It's a quiet sense of satisfaction with yourself. You know that you're living a good life. And this is what this is about. And this is then how you can engender this piti, the gladness in the mind. And then by staying with the breath, then again, passively, not doing anything, you're allowing the process to unfold. And this is why I use the word nudging the mind, because if you do things, you destroy the meditation. But nudging is just a kind of very gentle little bringing up a perception or something. Yeah, it doesn't disturb very much. And then the process carries on as a consequence of that. And then you go deeper. Yeah, you allow the process to unfold. You have the piti, then the sukha, which is a deeper kind of happiness. And then you're experiencing the mind, yeah, the processes of the mind. And then you calm those processes down. How? Just by being with them. They're calm by themselves. So this is the Vedana Nupassana as you have it here. And of course, very interesting and extremely worthwhile, and feeling that you are really touching some of the most important things in the human experience as you do this. One of the questions that sometimes arises at this point, well, what are you watching? Are you watching the breath or are you watching the feelings? And you still kind of, the breath is probably still your main object at this point, but the feelings are there at the same time. Yeah, they kind of, there's a more than one thing happening at once, basically. Yeah. So that is the contemplation of feelings in Anapanasati. Yeah. Then comes the contemplation of mind, which is the third one. And this is then equivalent to the third practice in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Citta Nupassana, the contemplation of mind. And this is how it is described in the Anapanasati Sutta, or in the Anapanasati process. They practice like this. I will breathe in, experiencing the mind. They practice like this. I will breathe out, experiencing the mind. They practice like this, I will breathe in, gladdening the mind. They practice like this, I will breathe out, gladdening the mind. They practice like this, I will breathe in, stilling the mind. They practice like this, I will breathe out, stilling the mind. They practice like this, I will breathe in, freeing the mind. They practice like this, I'll breathe out, freeing the mind. So this is the Citta Nupassana. And it starts off by experiencing the mind. So what does it mean to experience the mind? It may not be very obvious. And the way that Ajahn Brahm teaches this, and this is, I think, a very useful way of thinking about it, is that when you get rid of all the things that are not mind, then mind is what remains. And what are the things that are not mind? Well, the things that are not mind is the five senses. Yeah, that's really what it is. You could say the body, but the body is just experienced through the five senses anyway. So you can just reduce it down to the five senses. Yeah. So this is the answer here. You are letting go of the five senses. And of course, this is exactly what we're trying to do. This is one of the reasons I've talked quite a lot about the idea of senses and sense pleasures and these things. And then what you are left with, when those five senses start to fade away, the mind comes into focus. And the way that that is experienced is very often through this thing we call the nimitta. Yeah? We call in the suttas the obhasa, the light, and the rupa, the form or the shape. Rupa and obhasa, this is kind of the light in the mind, the sun or the moon or whatever it is that you see mentally. And that will... And that is very closely related to the five senses. When the five senses really fade, that is when this light, this nimitta, arises in the mind. If the five senses are prominent, the nimitta tends not to be there. The senses can still be a little bit in the background, but usually there is like an, what you might call an inverse relationship between the five senses and this nimitta in the mind. So this is where this starts to happen, right? This is how you experience that mind, this light, etc., in the mind. And then our job is then to deal with that nimitta in the right way. How do we contemplate, or how do we reflect on this nimitta? And this is what happens next here in the sutta. Yeah? So you then gladden the mind. You gladden that nimitta. Yeah? You make it more powerful. You make it even more blissful than it already is. How do you do that? Well, again, by being passive, by not doing anything, by focusing on the center of that nimitta, not looking at the edges, but focusing on the most blissful and the most powerful part. And as you do that, it becomes gradually more powerful. The more still you are, the more powerful it is. And that's why the next one is, you will breathe in stilling the mind. It says immersing the mind in samadhi, but I think I prefer just stilling the mind. And again, this is also done by focusing on the center of that nimitta and allowing things to become even more peaceful. Not doing anything, being with rather than focusing on. And as you are with this nimitta, it stills down, becomes even more peaceful. And again, you can see, again, the process is about two things. Stilling, calming things, and bliss. Yeah, gladdening the mind, stilling the mind. The furthering of the bliss and the furthering of the peace. These are the two main signposts of whether your meditation is going right or not. And this is again and again in the suttas. And then we've seen this throughout. But then, of course, it goes into the jhanas. And the jhanas are the same thing. More and more stilling, more and more bliss as you go into them. And then the very last one here is the very end, is freeing the mind. And freeing the mind is, again, not something you do. It is something that happens. Yeah, you're allowing it to happen by letting go and by not holding on to anything. And the freeing of the mind, which is vimochayang chittang. Vimochayang is related to the word vimuchati. Vimuchati is a liberation related to the word vimutti. Yeah, mutti, liberation. And so vimochayang chittang, allowing the mind to be freed. And the freeing here is a freeing into samadhi, the freeing from the five senses, from the five hindrances, from the will, from all of these things that limit the mind. And that is why the mind is liberated at this point. Yeah, samadhi is a kind of liberation of the mind. You feel that oppression is being let go of. And so the oppression of the five senses, the oppression of the five hindrances is left behind. The oppression of the doing mind is left behind. And then that is where you enter samadhi, you enter the jhana. So the jhanas are kind of included in anapanasati. They come at the very end of this breathing meditation, and they are implied by the idea of freeing the mind. So this is the development of the mind, yeah, through the breath again. The breath at this point is very, very much in the background, if present at all, and it's becoming less and less important, but it's still kind of the anchor, if you like, the thing that you come back to if you are in doubt, if you want to stabilize things, it is the breath. Again, how do you make this transition from the feelings to the a mind, yeah? We are, every time there is a transition from one satipatthana to another one, it can be tricky to achieve that transition. So how do we do that? Well, again, the way to understand this is to look at the thing that blocks you from making that transition. And the thing that blocks you will very often be an attachment to the five senses and the body, right? Because it is the five senses that we're letting go of as we're going through this. And so if you're having trouble there, just a gentle nudge of the mind, yeah, to remind you that the world is really not really all that interesting at all. The world is so unreliable, so uncertain, it's always going to let you down at the end of the day. And because it's always going to let you down, let it all go, right? Forget about those five senses. The five senses and the world is interchangeable because we experience the world through the five senses. So just bang, let it all go. Just a gentle reminder of the unsatisfactoriness that, okay, let me go, take refuge in the mind instead. Let me take refuge in the bliss of the samadhi nimitta. That is the right way. And then you learn how to deal with that. You learn not to fear it because you are, and gradually you get used to it. And then you become someone who practices the mind contemplation in anapanasati. So this is the process of anapanasati, the first 12 steps. There are four steps left, and this is the steps that concern insight And I don't really have enough time to look at those now, so we will look at those this afternoon. But the first 12 are already extremely interesting, yeah, because there are so many beautiful things going on here. 12 steps, each step being more happy, being more peaceful than the previous one. And already you're kind of starting to feel that you are in the presence of something extraordinarily meaningful as you do this. It gets even more meaningful further down, but already it is kind of extremely interesting. Yeah. So that is all for this morning. So again, please have a very nice lunch together. Keep on enjoying yourself. And we'll see you back at 3 o'clock this afternoon.